thanks for inviting me, first of all, to the conference. I was going to talk about two topics, 21st century bispectrum and dark matter baryon scatterings and the resulting cosmic heat flows. But because I think there's a topic that was not covered at all in this conference, I will also talk about massive neutrinos as the first part. So if you have a short attention span, it's going to be a perfect talk for you. So first part, massive neutrinos in the nonlinear regime of structure formation. This is work with Simeon Bird that we did back at the IIS a couple of years ago. And we are slowly working on a sequel, which I will talk about towards the end. So we've heard enough background. So let me just show, why it's important to measure neutrino mass, etc. Let me just show some simulations. This is from Rossi et al. Paper by 2014. This is a redshift 2.2, the gas, the dark matter, and the neutrinos for some of masses, either 0.8 or 0.4. If you don't see much in this plot, it's normal. It's because neutrinos are unclustered. Okay, and that's the main point that I want to show you from these plots. At high redshifts in particular, and it's still the case at low redshifts, for low masses, neutrinos are very unclustered. To understand this from scales, let's look as a function of redshifts to A, the nonlinear scale, which becomes larger and larger as time progresses. And today it's about 0.1, 0.2 inverse megaparsecs. And compare this with the free streaming scales, which is the characteristic distance that a neutrino can travel in Hubble time, and for different neutrino masses. So this middle line is basically barely consistent with the upper bounds that we have today on neutrino masses. Okay, so the sum of the masses is less than 0.2-ish EV. So this corresponds to a sum of masses of 0.3. So for scales which are larger than the nonlinear scale, so Ks which are smaller, the cold dark matter, hence the neutrinos, are linear. So they're unclustered. For scales which are smaller than the free streaming scale, neutrinos free stream, so they're unclustered. Okay? So anything on this plot that is either blue or pink, you expect the neutrinos to be unclustered. And you see that the whole plot is covered in blue and pink. So if I look at a particular redshift, I'm just putting a slice on this plot here, the linear regime overlaps with the free streaming regime. So again, you expect that at all scales, for the given the upper bounds that we have on the neutrino masses, we expect neutrinos to be unclustered. So this is what we've used in our approximation. So first of all, what needs to be solved? We have to solve, in all generality, the Boltzmann equation for the phase space density of the cold dark matter, the Boltzmann equation for the phase space density of the neutrinos, and these two must be solved conjointly with the Poisson equation, which is the gravitational potential that appears here, sourced by the density fluctuation of cold dark matter and that of neutrinos. Okay, and so n-body simulations solve for this by discretizing it into these bins in phase space as particles. They're not really particles, they're just bins of phase space. So our approach is to take this equation here and linearize it around the unperturbed Fermi-Dirac distribution. So you have the distribution function, which is the unperturbed one, which only depends on the velocity or the momentum of the neutrino, plus some perturbation. And this perturbation, the fractional perturbation, expected to be of order the gravitational potential over the neutrino velocity square. Okay? So you take this equation, you linearize it. So this term is the linear term here. So you put this on the right-hand side, you replace this by the unperturbed one. You can solve this explicitly in Fourier space, and you can get a linear transfer function from the gravitational potential at earlier times to the perturbed neutrino phase space density. Okay, so this is just a Green's function. And then, because what I care about is really the neutrino density, though from this equation you could obtain any of the moments of the neutrinos, you could obtain the bulk flow, the anisotropic stress, whatever, but all I care about really for the potential is the density. I just integrate this thing over velocities and I get, again, a linear transfer function, so a Green's function really, from the potential to at earlier times to the neutrino density at the current time.
And you ignore the shear stress and the gravity.
I ignore the shear stress, yes. Completely ignore the shear stress. Yes. So I just have the Poisson equation. I mean, I don't think any n-body simulations ever accounts for the shear stress. So just to emphasize this phi here, I didn't say anything about the phi. So this is the full nonlinear potential. Okay, so whatever phi you give me. So the algorithm we have is A at each time step. If you know delta CDM and delta neutrino, then you get phi, this is the Poisson equation. You store this gravitational potential at that time, little asterisk, which I'll come back to later on. At two from this phi and for the from the current state of the dark matter, velocity field and density field or
So the idea is that then neutrinos are just treated linearly in this.
Neutrinos respond linearly to the gravitational potential.
Well, okay. But
The
driving force is whatever it does, but neutrinos.
Right, I understand, but neutrinos are always treated linearly.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Neutrinos response is linear. So if you're if you know the current phi and you know the current positions and velocities of the dark matter particles, you just use your n-body code as your evolver for the next step dark matter density at t plus dt, and you use this equation, and conveniently this function here vanishes at t equals c prime. So you really are strictly sensitive to the gravitational potential at strictly earlier times, and we checked explicitly that extrapolating you get a very very small error. So you use this function to get delta nu at t plus dt, and then you go to the next time step. So by doing this, we're replacing, following a large number of neutrinos. You can ask Hoyle and his group again how large the neutrinos they follow by performing a simple integral.
So at every step, do you do that full time integral in the past?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But we cheat. I'll tell you how we cheat. We cheat a little bit. We do a full-time integral, which is easy. There's some other cheats. So, results. First of all, the total matter power spectrum, which is usually the first quantity of interest for lots of things. So here, I'm plotting the change in the power spectrum for a sum. This big M is the sum of neutrino masses of 0.3 eV. I write it 0, so it's the power spectrum with neutrinos divided by the power spectrum without neutrinos. The dashed line is the result from linear theory. You get something like 8 times the fraction of neutrino suppression. When you have a nonlinear clustering, you get even more suppression on the nonlinear scale. So this is what people are trying to get very accurately. The red dash curve is the result of Simeon's codes where neutrinos are treated as particles. And the blue curve is the result of this approximation where we have this analytic linear transfer from potential to neutrino density. So what we find is that at redshift 0, for sum of masses and neutrino masses of 0.3 eV, which again is barely in agreement with current limits, the agreement is about 0.2%. Okay, so it's a very good agreement. It's probably better than the accuracy of the codes themselves.
So this is the accuracy in what?
In the power spectrum.
The matter power spectrum.
In the matter power spectrum.
So if I cared about the neutrino power spectrum.
Next slide.
Okay.
So, but I want to spend some time on the good stuff. So if you increase the mass, of course, this accuracy goes lower. But even for neutrino mass of neutrino mass of 1.2 eV, which is completely excluded by current constraints, if you go to redshift bigger than 1, all of these agree to better than 1% for the matter power spectrum. Okay.
So this particle method, how does it fix the issue that Neil was talking about in the 2012 paper? Is Poisson noise a neutrino?
So with our method, we don't have any shot noise.
No, but that's
this is
the red one. Yeah, the red.
Well, they don't. I mean, no particle method fixes the shot noise. There's always shot noise.
Okay.
So I'll explain actually why.
But it's much less pathological than in one of
the patterns, right? I see.
Yeah, because it's only a fraction of neutrinos. So this is now, if you look at the neutrino power spectrum, if you were interested in, the cosmic neutrino background or something, if you wanted something that's really directed to the neutrino power spectrum. This is the power spectrum of the CDM in linear regime, CDM in a nonlinear regime. So you have this enhancement by, 1.5, 2 orders of magnitude at very small scales. This is neutrinos where everything is assumed to be linear, so what you would get from one of your linear Boltzmann codes. And this is what we get in this work. So this is why several people showed, Derek and Huangmin et al. Showed this here. So what we get is really the enhancement from the linear neutrino is the same as the enhancement from the dark matter. So basically delta nu is linearly proportional to phi. So delta nu over delta linear is just phi over phi linear, okay? But what we see is that, again, and this was shown before, the neutrinos actually cluster more than what we obtain in our approximation. So this is a failure for approximation if you are interested in neutrino far spectrum.
So this
itself.
Is after subtracting the shot noise?
No, so this is the shot noise. This is the shot noise.
But if you could just subtract the
shot
noise?
So shot noise, you can only subtract it in the plots.
Yeah.
You don't subtract it in the simulation.
Sure, I understand. But after
so
you subtract it, then
after you subtract it, you would see some bump, and then you know it would get crazy because it's not accurate enough to subtract it all the way down. So the reason why this has almost zero effect on the matter power spectrum itself is that, first of all, you can see that there are many orders of magnitude. So delta nu is much less than delta CDM. On top of this, you have to multiply this by the fraction of neutrinos, which is, 1 or 2%. And this is also why even this nasty shot noise does not affect the results so much, because, again, it's small in any case compared to the CDM, and you multiply it by the fraction of neutrinos. So
how can the neutrinos have any effect at all?
So the main effect of neutrinos is that, and I would be willing to bet that you would get it to 1% accuracy, you just replace delta nu, you say it's delta CDM over something like 1 plus k over k phi streaming squared. You do this, you'll get something like 1%. And you can find a better fitting function. But this is the main effect, is that you part of the CDM does not cluster, and this is scale-dependent effect. You may as well use a simple method.
But didn't your committee say that basically your expression should work, like the first slide was?
Yeah, exactly. No, it works. This is just because I'm being honest. I'm showing what doesn't work about it, but it works.
So, but why does it work? Like, if it should work?
Sorry?
Like in your first slide says.
Oh yeah. Okay. I'll get that.
First slide, you make convincing
arguments
that work for
yes.
everything.
Yes. Okay.
What doesn't work? But everything works.
So my first slide was saying the neutrino should be unclustered on all scales,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is true. The neutrinos. So this is kqp of k equals 1. Kqp nu of k is much less than 1. Neutrinos are indeed unclustered on all scales. So it is true. It is true, but assuming they're linearly responding to the potential is not correct. So I'll explain to you why.
Okay.
So first of all, this is the cheat I was talking about. So when I showed Simeon this integral, I was like, you just have to store the potential every time and you have a single integral. He said, no. I can store the full 3D potential at one time. That's all you get. It's just too much memory. You cannot store a full three-dimensional, 500 cube modes at every time. So what we do is that we approximate this integral by saying this phi of k t prime is just phi of k at time t times the ratio of the power spectra. Okay, so we're assuming that it preserves the same phase, basically. So this is true. A, on large linear scales, because linear theory tells you that this is equal to this times this on linear scales. On scales which are much smaller than the free streaming scale, so this function here only has supports on time separations which are less, so for a given wavelength, it takes some time to cross this wavelength for neutrinos. So if you go to times which are much larger than this time, this function goes to zero. So neutrinos have a very short memory because they have very large velocities. So on scales which are less than the free streaming scale, by definition, this quantity is much less than 1/Hubble time. This is the definition of the free streaming scale. So this integral has support only on times differences much less than 1/Hubble time. And so on these, you can expect that the potential will preserve its phases. It will not be completely mixed up by nonlinear evolution. Okay.
Sorry, it seems to me that this it's a bit like treating phi with a linear, at least for the time dependence.
Yes, yeah, at least the phase of the phi, yes. Exactly, so that's what I'm justifying. On linear scales, it's true.
Exactly, but it's wrong.
And on nonlinear scales, it's wrong,
exactly.
But because this integral only cares about really recent times, then it's okay. Like phi is not going to change drastically its phase.
Right. So this makes that. Really is fascinated by those you're not going to see.
the wakes, if they require a different phase, indeed they will not see. And this is why I was asking if they could show me the cross-correlation. So indeed, this has built in the assumption that neutrinos have the same phase as the CDM. They're correlated one-to-one with the CDM, which is not exactly true. So can this be the reason for the indeterminate of P? New, and I think, Whaley, we talked about this. I don't know if you're still convinced this could be it. So this is not the reason, and so these guys say no. This is Augustin Ricauchy and Hermann Schwarz. So if you take the power spectrum of this, you can show by Cauchy-Schwarz that it's always less than the power spectrum of this. So this approximation would give us an overestimate of the power spectrum if this was the correct equation. Okay. So what is wrong is our very starting point is to linearize the Boltzmann equation for neutrinos.
But you're assuming that simulations are correct. Maybe simulations are wrong.
Well, I think it's. I will trust.
I mean, this Schadler's problem that Neil was trying to address. I mean,
but, I mean, they got the bump. Like this. This bump, I mean, in the plus, I don't remember who was showing, Derek maybe. I mean, they can get the shot noise, you know, to lower scales. I mean, you can see on several orders of magnitude where you trust that there's no shot noise, that you get slightly more neutrino clustering than you would predict this, with this method.
Yeah, but shot noise gives you artificial clustering in neutrinos, right?
It gives you in a very, you know, it's just like a flat, in P of K, it's just flat.
No, that's just, at one snapshot, but the thing is, shot noise grows because of
that. No. So, okay, right.
You're saying if the shot
doesn't grow as strongly for the neutrinos because they're a subdominant gravitation.
Sure. It doesn't grow as strongly, but it does, I mean, it does help a little bit.
So you're saying,
then you can test that. It just turn off the gravitational force of neutrinos at anybody.
Yeah.
And only that damage driven by the CDM, it still is too high. That's
Oh, okay. I see. Right. And your thing, there is no self-gravity.
We do have gravity, but you can turn it off, and we tested that.
And you still have. Okay. So what's going on here? This is my explanation, and we're working on this.
Uh-huh.
Neutrinos are not all the same. Okay. So neutrinos has a whole distribution of velocities. So the overdensity neutrinos is like a fraction of fast neutrinos times the overdensity of fast neutrinos plus a fraction of slow neutrinos times delta slow neutrinos. Now, this guy is much less than one. Fast neutrinos do not cluster. And there's some critical velocity below which, I'll talk about this, they don't cluster at all. Now, the slow ones, there are always some arbitrarily slow neutrinos, some arbitrarily cold neutrinos, then they do cluster to arbitrarily large clustering, actually. They get arbitrarily close to CDM. But if they make a small fraction of the overall neutrino population, then this whole quantity can still be much less than one, which is what we actually observe. So our treatment, we have assumed that all neutrinos behave like the fast ones. In fact, some of them do not, and this is where I think the error comes from. This is to illustrate this a little more quantitatively. So this is work in preparation. So here we have adapted our method to have single velocity bins. So you don't have a Fermi Dirac distribution, you just say have a distribution where I have a delta function at the magnitude and velocity, and I can do a similar analytic approximation. For fast neutrinos here, so the blue line is simulation where we had neutrinos as test particles in the simulation. And you can see that the red line, okay, it's kind of wiggly because there's interpolation, but it really follows the blue line. Okay, it's very close to the blue line. This is for unperturbed velocity today of 500 kilometers per second. Now, and KQP of K is like at most 6%. Now, if I look at neutrinos whose unperturbed velocity today is 200 kilometers per second, so this is a statement that's independent of their, you know, Fermi Dirac, blah, 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 it's just a question about individual velocity. This is our linear approximation, linear response approximation, and this is the true clustering seen in the simulation, and you can see that here it hits, you know, order one, and it's underestimated a lot, but our results. So I think this is the reason. And so what is this epsilon here? So if we take 500 kilometers per second as, you know, the velocity above which things are fine, so for neutrino mass of 0.1 eV, this corresponds to 94% of neutrinos, and the slow ones to 6%. So this epsilon is like a few percent in this picture here. So summary of part one, given the current constraints on neutrino masses. Neutrinos are unclustered on all scales. They're not linear, but they're unclustered on all scales. the total matter power spectrum, you can, if that's what you're interested in, you can get very accurately with our semi-linear method, which really takes no computational time, no memory. If you are interested
what's
in neutrino...
What's the fractional error on the neutrino effect on the power spectrum? Sorry, I didn't follow.
The fractional error on the of neutrino effect.
Right, yes. Well, yeah.
So I think I give the fractional error on the power spectrum
right.
itself.
Right, neutrinos themselves are making, you're saying, a few percent.
Right.
So is a fractional error, therefore, like, order unity? Is that what you're saying?
No. The effect of neutrinos is like
20%. 20%.
Right. So, okay, it's five times more than this number, I guess. On if you're asking the effect, the change of that suppression is five times more.
Right, yeah, I know. Well, yeah.
But again, I don't know if I would believe...
That's the relevant number you should be quoting, right? Because, you know, the point of doing the simulation is to quantify the effect of the neutrinos.
Okay.
Right.
Sure, but then the power spectrum is not accurate to 1% from the simulation, or is it? I don't think it is, but...
Yeah, 1% is getting...
And also, okay, what I would argue is that in any case, what goes beyond this point in simulations with particles is not accurate because this is what neutrinos do. So this is closer to reality than this.
For the n-body, I agree.
For the n-body.
Yeah, but there's other methods.
I'm sorry. Right. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know what's the best metric to compare it to. All right.
Okay, so but, yeah.
Okay. So what we're working on now is based on this idea that you have the fast and the slow neutrinos. So what we would do is have our method up to redshift 1 or 2. Then at redshift 1 or 2, only the 6% or whatever, 10% of neutrinos that will eventually be clustered, those we make as particles. And we follow as regular CDM particles in the simulations. So this way we can really focus the computational time on the things that need the computational time.
So
that's my question.
Didn't
Hannes start
as like a student that did something very similar, some degree,
convertible
particles?
Yes, I think they did something like that.
Isn't
this
very similar to this?
I think they tried to convert, but they, honestly, they did it in a complicated way. They tried to do it at different redshifts and whatnot.
Okay.
And
but
I think you can just.
Very similar, right?
They did not do. So when they did the grid, what they did is they assumed. They took this completely linear prescription for neutrinos,
okay.
Which not only is underestimated power spectrum, but also the phases are wrong.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it takes like the initial condition phases and assumes that neutrino keep these initial condition phases. Whereas here, we're actually, you know, if you see the simulations, neutrinos are actually in phase. I mean, this is what the people have been emphasizing this. Neutrinos follow, trace the dark matter. It's just like a, you know, blurrier version of the dark matter. Okay, all right, yeah. And by the way, this is just, if you any of you have read these papers, if you were interested in doing something similar for the CDM, like perturbing the phase space density and powers of the potential, it doesn't work, okay? It works for neutrinos.
But
it doesn't work
for CDM.
It doesn't work for CDM.
So what Bartleman did is fine for something he didn't do with opinion.
Exactly, yeah.
But I mean, because dark matter is nonlinear, that's the
yes,
okay.
Yeah, because the V of the dark matter, V square of dark matter is phi.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's smoothly flow into the next topic. So maybe, how much time do I have left?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay, so I'll go to part 3. So part 2 was... Okay, I'm going to say two words about part 2. This is work with Julian Munoz, who's a graduate student of Mark Minkowski at Johns Hopkins. What we did is say, okay, let me just say one slide. The question is, can we measure the bispectrum of 21 centimeter fluctuations at redshift 30, okay, or more? Why 30 or more? Because then things, as Richard was saying, things are simpler. There are no luminous sources. Things are supposed to be very simple. You can use linear theory or even higher order perturbation theories to get everything correctly. There are many challenges, okay, and we heard some of the challenges even at redshift 5, you know, multiplied by z to some power for the challenges at redshift 30. System temperature is huge, foregrounds, the volume, the sheer volume of the data is going to be amazing and very hard to deal with. And another one, so what we dealt with here is a rather simpler problem compared to those ones, is the secondaries. non-Gaussianities. So for the CMB, the statistical error is 5 on FNL. The secondary is 5.7. This is due to ISW Lensing correlation. For the 21 centimeter bispectrum, you have nonlinear gravitational collapse. You have also the fact that 21 centimeter is a nonlinear tracer of the underlying density. And so the ratio of the primary bispectrum to the secondary bispectrum is actually 10 to minus 3 times FNL. So the bias in FNL due to the secondary bispectrum would be a order 1,000. Okay? Yes. So if you take for a single righteous slice, you go to L max of 10 to the 5, and you just take your naive estimator. Well, because of the fact that the 21 centimeter fluctuations are highly non-Gaussian, even a redshift 50 or 100, you would get something like 1,000 or several thousand. Okay, so that's the main point of this paper. And what we did as a sort of proof of principle.
Is it as pessimistic as it sounds?
No. So actually, it's still manageable. But it's something that you have to be aware of. It's still manageable because the shapes are very, you know, there's an overlap, and actually more overlap than I thought in the shapes. There's like something like 0.8, 0.9 overlap, and the ratio of the, you know, the scalar product of primary times secondary over their norms. However, you can always marginalize over coefficients. So the question, what coefficients to marginalize over, you know, it's something that we will do in 30 years whenever these things actually are launched. But as a proof of principle, we marginalize over 4 coefficients. The idea being that, you know, among a lot of things that we don't know to that accuracy, for example, cosmological parameters are not known to 0.1% accuracy. But, you know, in 30 years, we will probably know them to 0.1% accuracy. We don't know the detailed, you know, collision rates, etc. You can ask Chris Sigurdsson to tell you about some, you know, percent level corrections to the spin temperature. Okay, so we marginalize over a few coefficients. And so then the signal-to-noise ratio is reduced by a factor of 5 because of this. So it's not so bad. And we made some highly optimistic forecasts because, you know, I've learned that you have to end the paper with an optimistic statement. But so this is all in the cosmic variance limits, neglecting foregrounds, etc. So the main message of this paper, and again, Julian Munoz is the one who did a lot of the calculations, is that 21 centimeter fluctuations, even at redshift 50 or 100, are highly intrinsically non-Gaussian. And it's not a showstopper a priori. There are other showstoppers probably, but you have to account for it.
Okay, so was this the paper that kind of claimed if we had a telescope covering the entire dark side of the moon?
Yeah.
Then maybe.
Yeah, we didn't get into these details. So let me finish with this, which I'm quite excited about. So this is now cosmic heat flows. This is cosmic flow conference. So this is work with Jens Kluba, who is one of the spectral distortion experts, and Mark Amankowski, recently accepted to PRL. So this is about setting constraints on elastic scattering of dark matter particles with standard model particles, either photons or electrons or protons. So the standard, the direct detection constraints on the WIMP nucleon cross-section, you've probably seen plots like this, where you have experiments such like xenon 100 that gives you some constraint as a function of the WIMP mass. And this cannot give you anything about masses less than a few GeV of the dark matter. The dark matter mass less than a few GeV. The reason is that the dark matter has to be able to produce a recoil in the nucleon. Okay, the target nucleus. So this is why here you hit a wall. You cannot say anything. Recently, Essig et al. Suggested that you could constrain dark matter electron scattering with the same experiments by looking at the rate of ionizations induced by this dark matter electron scattering. And here the same wall happens, but at a few MeV, because it takes much less energy to ionize an electron than to give recoil to a massive nucleus. Okay, but the whole range of low masses are currently completely unconstrained by these direct detection experiments. So if dark matter scatters off baryons, this will have, of course, cosmological implications, which have been used to already set some constraints. The first implication is that you have a momentum exchange. So this is the momentum equation for the baryons. gravitational potential force, the gravitational force. This is the coupling with the photons through Thompson scattering. And this is a new coupling that would arise if dark matter would scatter off baryons. So that their two bulk flows would want to stick together. And you have the same term normalized with appropriate ratios of densities for the dark matter equation. So this effect has been used to set constraints already on the dark matter baryon cross-section in several works, okay, using the CMB in large-scale structure. There's another effect, which is the fact that there's a heat exchange. There's not only a momentum exchange, but a heat exchange. So the dark matter and the baryon will want to have the same temperature if they interact with one another. And the dark matter, if it's the dark matter, if there was no baryons, it would just be cold. But because there are baryons, it will exchange heat with the baryons. This can have an effect on 21 centimeter spin temperature, which I don't have time to talk about, but this is also work in preparation with Julian Munoz and Eli Kovetz. And it will have an effect on CMB spectral distortions. So this is the cosmic microwave background black body spectrum, which is currently, I think, the most precise black body existing like ever. So it was measured by FIRES to be a black body to within 50 parts in a million. There's a proposed experiment, which is PIXI, which is the same people of FIRES, so they should know what they're talking about. They say they can get it to a 10 to the minus 8 precision of the distortions of the spectrum of the CMB with respect to black body. So what's the very basic physics in three words? If you inject energy, or actually if you remove energy from the photons or the plasma at redshift greater than 2 million, then photon creation and destruction processes are very efficient. So this energy will be thermalized. And all the result will be to have a black body at a slightly different temperature. It will not distort the black body. If you inject this energy between redshifts of 50,000 and 2 million, then you cannot no longer create and destroy photons anymore, but you can very efficiently change the photon frequency through Thompson scattering. So you will reach an equilibrium at constant number of photons, which is a chemical given by a Bose-Einstein distribution with a chemical potential. Okay, this is called a mu type distortion. And finally, if you inject or remove energy from the photons at redshift less than about 50,000, then even this scattering, Thompson scattering, does not re-equilibrate the photon frequency efficiently enough. And what you get is something that's exactly the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, and it's usually called a Y distortion. All right, so I told you about this. Now, what mechanisms can inject energy? So people have thought of familiar mechanisms. I'm just citing a few here. One that arises in the standard scenario is the dissipation of acoustic waves, silk damping. So this injects a tiny bit of energy. Typically, distortions of 10 to minus 9 or so are predicted. Dark matter, if it annihilates or decays, it can inject energy into your plasma. If you have primordial magnetic field, and I'm sure you can come up with more processes. A process that extracts energy from the photon is slightly less intuitive, and this was shown by Kluba and Sunyaev very recently. So, and this works as follows. If you left the non-relativistic baryons alone, they would cool down adiabatically, so their temperature would go as scale factor to minus 2. So, you know, T dot would be minus 2 times Hubble times T. Now, photons, Thompson scatter with electrons, and then the electrons share their heat with the rest of the baryons. And so they maintain TB equals TCMB to very, very close accuracy, all the way down to redshift about 200. And after that, you can observe the difference in 21 centimeters. But so a redshift of 10 to the 4, whatever, this is like very, very, very accurate. And so the baryon temperature goes as A to the minus 1 instead of A to minus 2. So the rate of change is minus H times TB. So the difference between these two is the energy that the photons have given to the baryons. Okay? So the net heat flow from the CMB to the baryons is 3/2 of number density of baryons times the difference in these two rates of changes. And so then this is a heat flow into the baryons. So if I ask what is the change of the energy density of the photons, it's minus Q. And this A to the 4 stuff is just to say I'm only accounting for the change of the energy density of the photons that is not due to the expansion of the universe. Okay. Otherwise, of course, it will change because of the expansion of the universe. if you use the fact that rho gamma goes as a to the minus 4, you plug it back, you integrate this equation over time, you use the fact that the photon density energy is, you know, a few times some constant number times number density of photons and temperature of photons, and then T gamma is equal to TB, then you can do the math. You get a constant ratio of baryon to photons time integral of HDT, which is just logarithmic logarithm of scale factors. The scale factors, what goes in, a minimum is corresponds to ratio of 2 million, the time at which this injection actually distorts the CMB. And the maximum scale factor is either the time at which photons decouple from the baryons, ratio 200, or the time at which you, if you're interested in new distortions only, is ratio 50,000. Okay, so the main point is that you have a photon to baryon ratio here. That is 10 to minus 10 times a log, 10 to minus 9. So this happens in the standard universe. Now, if we add dark matter scattering to the mix, if dark matter, first it has to be non-relativistic, so it would cool down as 8 to the minus 2. If it scatters off photons, you have exactly the same effect I just described as with the baryons. Okay? If it scatters off nuclei or electrons, then the effect also occurs, but in an indirect way. So every time photons give energy to the electrons, they have to share it now with also the dark matter. So the effective heat capacity or the thermal inertia of the overall plasma is bigger. Both effects will lead to a distortion, which is of order the number density of dark matter divided by that of the photons times log of the decoupling scale factor over redshift, A of redshift 2 million. So this guy depends on the cross section. This has the cross section information. And this goes as 1 over the mass of the dark matter. And so the lighter dark matter, the bigger distortion you can probe. So I have just 2 plots to show and I'm done. This is the distortion for velocity independent scattering with protons. We also studied general power law dependence in the paper as a function of the cross section for different dark matter masses. So first trend you see is that as you increase the dark matter mass, you lower the number density of dark matter particles, so you get a smaller distortion. Second trend you see is that as you increase the cross section, of course, the distortion increases because the dark matter is tightly coupled to the photons for a longer time. And finally, you see that these distortions reaches a plateau, which is when the dark matter is coupled at all times. Okay, so the maximum number you can get here, this plateau here, is the ratio in number of the dark matter to the photons. And so something like FIRAS, for example, can only constrain masses that are lower than about 0.2 MeV. And something like PIXI will be able to say something about the cross section for masses which are less than about 1 GeV. So in the plot, in the constraint, so these solid lines are actual constraints that are the first constraints in this mass regime for elastic scattering of dark matter with either protons or electrons. And this is using FIRAS, saying that the distortion is less than 5 times 10 minus 5. And as I said, there is a wall at 0.1 MeV, because if you go to heavier masses, no matter how tightly coupled they are, they will never distort the CMB by 5 times 10 minus 5. And if you include, and these are the dashed lines are the forecast for PIXI, so you could continue these constraints all the way to a mass of about a GeV. So
what did you mean for satellites? Is this already excluded?
The wet line, sorry?
The dashed line, the midway satellite.
So this is the current constraint from sigma over m, because it factorizes sigma over m, from the number count of Milky Way satellites. I forgot the exact reference, but I can give it to you. So our constraint is actually better in here than this.
Not by much.
Not by much, but also this is for energy-independent cross-section. We can actually constrain energy-dependent cross-sections. And in any case, it's a different way of constraining it. I think it's a little cleaner than counting the Milky Way satellites, but it might be a little more robust. But
this is Fermi, you mean, right?
It's not Fermi. I forgot the author. I think it's Céline Boehm.
Why would interactions between dark matter and baryon spectrum?
Because it would suppress the dark matter power spectrum on small scales. I think that's the idea. You suppress the small scale dark matter power spectrum. And then you have to run a simulation and have, and, you know, count the satellites in your simulation and then compare.
I don't know how to calculate that. I mean, yeah.
I think the effect is here. I don't know how, you know, what's the error bar in this number, but I think the effect is here.
It's just the cutoff of power spectrum.
Yeah, I think it's like the cutoff of power spectrum.
Yeah, but you don't know how to translate, you know, the cutoff in the, you know,
yeah,
the cutoff in the linear power spectrum into the number of.
Right,
process.
So you're on a simulation.
I think, what slides are we done?
No, I'm done. So.
Okay. Wait, but the fact. Yes.
No, I was just saying that we don't know how to translate the linear power spectrum cutoff into the mass function.
Yeah. But, which is why this is cool, because this is more robust.
Okay.
All right.
So, just one thing.